And welcome back. An exhibition at the St. Louis Art Museum is exploring changes in men's fashion over the past 300 years. Created by the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the appearance of the exhibition in St. Louis is the second and only other planned stop in the United States, aside from L.A. Producer Alex Hoyer went to the Art Museum, and he has more.
The exhibition is called Reigning Men, Fashion in Menswear. It explores the evolution of what men wore between 1715 and 2015. And this Reigning Men exhibit, Reigning, spelled R-E-I-G-N-I-N-G, is about the kind of man who wore a certain style of clothing, the style of the clothing itself, and the culture of the time. It also challenges the notion that fashion is equated with femininity, and it takes a look at how the concept of masculinity has changed. The exhibition is thematic rather than chronological and is divided into five galleries. Here at the St. Louis Art Museum, Jenny Cordenovis is the assistant curator of decorative arts and design, and the first of five galleries is called Revolution Evolution. And surrounded by a couple dozen mannequins, Cordenovis explains the concept of this gallery.
So this is the idea that cultural, political, and social events have had a major impact on fashion. So looking at the way that these kind of historical events reverberate in clothing, in menswear in particular, obviously. It's broken down into some sub-themes, so it looks at the French Revolution and just more generally revolution and anarchy. So they also include kind of punks and other types of rule breakers in that equation. It looks at aesthetes and hippies, so people that have used kind of luxurious textiles or have kind of dressed outside the norms to assert their viewpoints. Then we go into kind of youth and rebellion, so that's kind of thinking about the way that youth culture, dance culture, music have affected fashion. And then finally, it looks at the dandy, which is the sort of proverbial, restrained, elegant gentleman, you know, who's, again, kind of asserted his fashionable sense in a very different way from some of the other types in the gallery.
And if we're trying to paint a picture here, could you do that for me? I mean, there are dozens of mannequins surrounding us.
Yeah, so we're basically in a sea of mannequins. They all have these kind of elaborate hairstyles, I have to say. Well, not all of them, but many of them have these quite elaborate hairstyles that were fashioned specifically for the exhibition. They kind of run the gamut in terms of color. This is not an exhibition about the gray flannel suit. It does have a gray flannel suit in it, but it really is about kind of color and texture and sort of luxurious materials oftentimes, or, you know, really bright, appealing, vibrant patterns.
If you would, pick out one piece that really stands out to you in this Revolution Evolution gallery.
So I guess I'll probably have to talk about, can I pick out two?
Yes.
It's too hard otherwise. So I'm a Francophile, so I have to pick out something from the French Revolution. So I would probably bring up this ensemble here, which is a three-piece suit that is kind of in muted green and has these kind of striped brown trousers. Not trousers. He's actually wearing breeches. So, you know, pants that kind of stop just below the knee. And then he's got a bicorn hat on, which happens to be original and quite rare, with a cockade, which was a tricolore ribbon, so red, white, and blue ribbon, that was actually a way to show your allegiance to the revolution. And this is an original cockade, and it's quite rare. And I bring it up partially because allegedly it has its origins with the Marquis de Lafayette, who's kind of a famous visitor to St. Louis. He felt like the French needed a patriotic symbol, and he believed that this was probably the way. This was the way to go. The red and the blue reference the city of Paris, and unfortunately, they also reference the Orleans, who were the rivals to the Bourbons, who were of course the monarchy at the time. And so he included white, which was the color of the Bourbons. So it's this kind of nonpartisan way to kind of assert your support for the revolution. And actually in the pocket of this long coat that was worn with the ensemble was a revolutionary pamphlet. So if we ever doubted the wearer's allegiance, we know through this kind of amazing survival, this, you know, amazing kind of material cultural history.
One of the things that you said before we started talking was that the French Revolution was kind of a turning point in menswear. Why is that?
So there's, it's believed that it's kind of a democratization of fashion to some degree. You know, there's obviously a breakdown of class at that period in time, too. So a lot of the constraints that you would see prior to that did not exist after that. It was also this way for people to kind of like really assert themselves, not, you know, and everybody from working class militants like the sans-culottes to, you know, to aristocrats who supported the revolution. You know, it was a way for all of these people to kind of visually show their allegiances. And so fashion became a really powerful tool. And that's kind of how we see it as this turning point.
You mentioned that you wanted to talk about one other piece in this gallery.
One of the rarest pieces in this show is this really fabulous zoot suit. It's a really exaggerated version of kind of the iconic zoot suit, which is this generally kind of wool, oftentimes striped suit that was worn in the dance halls in the kind of 1930s and 40s. It was oftentimes worn by African Americans, Chicanos, immigrant groups, and was, you know, kind of associated with youth and sort of rebellion of the period. So zoot suits tend to have these really wide leg kind of, or they have trousers that sort of balloon out at the knees, and then they come cuffed around the ankles, quite tightly so that you could actually dance. And then they have these exaggerated shoulders as well. This particular zoot suit has pockets that are not tacked down that actually would flap out when the wearer was dancing. And has these really exaggerated proportions. The LA County Museum of Art, who organized the exhibition, looked for 10 years to find this kind of zoot suit.
Really, that long?
Yeah, and then when it actually came to auction, it went for like six figures. They were on a bidding war with another institution who was dying for a zoot suit. So it's just, you know, shows this kind of the rarity of some of these pieces. You know, even 20th century pieces that you would think would be easy to find, in fact, are very difficult to find.
I feel like we could spend probably another hour just in this gallery, but why don't we move to the next one?
Sure. So this gallery is called East West, and it's really looking at kind of cultural intersections between mostly Europe and Asia. One of the earliest pieces in the show is actually in this gallery, and it's one of my favorites. It's a amazing 1720s lace pattern banyan, which is sort of a fancy word for a sort of loose robe that was worn by European gentlemen in the 18th century and into the 19th century. And this one happens to have this amazing green silk brocaded French textile. And it just is kind of, again, kind of a rare and really exquisite survival, and shows the kind of way men could be a little bit more colorful when they were relaxing at home. In the 18th century, that's not maybe the best parallel because of the fact that they were still wearing quite ostentatious things on the street. But when you get into the 19th century and the 20th century in particular, you know, these kind of at-home robes, these banyans, were a way for men to kind of relax in color and vibrancy at home. So you'll see, again, a kind of a shockingly modern-looking smoking suit that's actually a Victorian relic. And it's sort of purple and red-striped, you know, could have belonged to Hugh Hefner kind of look. But indeed, it's a 19th-century piece and something that might surprise visitors when they're coming.
In terms of the materials that the clothing throughout the exhibit is made of, I imagine the type of material is influenced by the time in which it's made. Do you have any comment on how designers would decide which materials to use?
That's a good question. So, so particularly in the 19th century, wool becomes extremely popular. And so, you know, the kind of proverbial suit that we think about, you know, the kind of the gray flannel suit or the suit that, you know, men wear out in men and women wear out in business. That's made of wool, not by fluke. It's because wool is easy to mold and easy to shape and is durable and drapes nicely. So there are all these kind of qualities of that particular material that made it particularly good for suiting. You know, silks in earlier periods were extreme. They could be cool. They could be obviously quite comfortable. They also showed your status. They were quite luxurious. Having an entire robe made of silk brocade in this period in the 18th century was, you know, something that was kind of reserved just for really elite gentlemen.
That's Jenny Cordonovis, the assistant curator of decorative arts and design at the St. Louis Art Museum. And we're here at the museum's Reigning Men exhibition, one that explores the evolution of men's fashion over 300 years, from 1715 to 2015. Finishing with the second of five thematic galleries, we move through the largest of the galleries, one called Uniformity, and get to the fourth, called Body Consciousness.
So this is maybe the most sort of provocative of all of the galleries. This is asking us to kind of challenge our idea that men have not been preoccupied with sort of modifying or perfecting their bodies, either through tailoring, through molding, cinching, kind of corseting, padding, or through diet and exercise, so that they can wear, you know, skimpy swimsuits and even thongs, which we happen to have two in this gallery. So it looks at not only tailoring and sheer dressing, but also kind of traces the evolution of swimwear in the 20th century.
In terms of body consciousness, I know that the fashion industry is often critiqued with the way that they portray body form in terms of that influencing both men and women, that they need to have a certain body type, mm-hmm. and that has a host of negative consequences. And I know fashion designers have thought of that effect of their work. Do you have any thoughts on that?
From the exhibition's perspective, I think what has been kind of enlightening is just how much the ideal silhouette has changed over time.
How so?
So kind of in the 18th century, the ideal silhouette for a man was really more pear-shaped. It was to kind of show, you would have like a nice round belly to show, you know, what a great dinner you could eat, how well fed you were. And then in the 19th century, it becomes much more kind of hourglass. So that's the kind of the dandy look, and that's really when tailoring comes in. They would pad out your shoulders, you would cinch in your waist, you could even pad your calves to give you kind of like the look that you were, you know, going for. And then in the 20th century, it's much more about the kind of athletic look, maybe something we might associate with Olympians or even kind of male models, you know, this kind of triangular shaped physique. So, you know, there's kind of an ideal silhouette no matter what century you're looking at and just how malleable that is. So who knows what's going to happen in the next century? You know, maybe these pretty unrealistic expectations will be, will change, and a new fashionable physique will come about. So, you know, I think that if you look at the scope of history, it actually is sort of comforting, maybe. Mm-hmm. Bring back the pear.
and I must admit that when I even learned that the St. Louis Art Museum was doing an exhibition on men's fashion, that I was like, because in popular culture, when the term fashion comes up, at least I most often think of women's fashion. And if you see any kind of fashion show, it's usually women's fashion. And mm-hmm. you mentioned that this body consciousness gallery is part of an effort to express that men have always been concerned about the way that they look. How has the way that men have viewed fashion, how has that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. In the 18th century, men were encouraged and expected to be as splendid as women, thoughtfully and kind of elaborately adorned. In the 19th century, there is this kind of, some scholars refer to it as the kind of great male renunciation. It's this idea that to be fashionable is to be feminine and to be frivolous and is not serious. And so although men were really concerned with the way they looked in the 19th century and, you know, used all kinds of tailoring techniques to perfect their physiques and to perfect their appearances, there was suddenly this kind of association with fashion as something that was distinctly feminine. And that has kind of reverberated into the 20th century. And that may explain why, you know, fashion is still so kind of linked with women's wear and with and the sort of feminine idea. So, and it's just sort of not true. and I think it will change again, or maybe I think it is changing now.
And speaking of changing, I want to walk to the very end of the exhibition as we end this. And there are three mannequins in front of us, black, white, and black outfits. And this is kind of imagining what the future of fashion might look like. And so I'd like you to kind of describe what the exhibition envisions as the future of fashion potentially. Sure. And when we talk about the future, about how many years do you think we're talking about?
I mean, these ensembles are just from, like, you know, a few years ago, but I oftentimes some of the more avant-garde ideas from the runway don't really hit, you know, the high street, as you might say, or hit the malls until a few years. But this these three pieces show not only the global approach to fashion, so it's a kind of a amazing sort of suit, black suit, but that's adorned with ruffles, and it's by Rei Kawakubo, and it's for Comme des Garçons, so this is a Japanese designer. In the center you have an entirely kind of white ensemble, and that it is... for lack of a better word, kind of a dress that looks like it's been fashioned from a very luxurious bedsheet and then topped with a tailored white coat. And this is by Rick Owens, who's an American designer who's based in Paris. And then on the right, you have a sleeveless black adaptation of a kandora, which is a kind of traditional Middle Eastern style of clothing for men. And this this is made by Ahmed Abdelrahman, who is the designer of Tamanya, which is a Emirati brand and also a Parisian. He's also based in Paris.
Now, if I were to just look at these, not on a mannequin, but I don't know if I'd be able to tell whether it was designed for a man or a woman. And is that part of the future of dress, is that it's less gender specific?
I think that's what the creators from LACMA, I think, were sort of getting at when they chose these three ensembles, that maybe the future of fashion is about androgyny and about kind of a breakdown of some of these walls, kind of. You know, just the other day there was an article in the New York Times about how a lot of the runway shows are showing skirts for men. Of course, men have worn skirts for millennia. That's not something new. But, you know, maybe the future of fashion is actually looking back to that, to those days. You know, I think that especially with also the absence of color, you know, it's sort of asking us to kind of also use our imagination and what the future might look like. You know, it's kind of creating a blank slate for us to think about.
That's curator Jenny Cordonovis of the St. Louis Art Museum talking with producer Alex Hoyer. The exhibition Reigning Men, Fashion in Men's Wear is open now through September 17th. To see photos of some of the items discussed, visit our website at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. And now, commentator Nancy Kranzberg offers these thoughts on women and the visual arts.
In general, many women have broken the glass ceiling and occupy very prestigious positions, not only in our city, but throughout the country and the world. We finally have a female mayor in St. Louis. Women are finally being given their due in the arts as well. Just looking at the visual arts, the museums I have frequented recently have featured women. The Contemporary Art Museum in St. Louis, CAM, has just recently closed an exhibition featuring three female artists. Catherine Bernhardt, a St. Louis native, returned to her hometown to create a new site-specific mural on the museum's 60-foot-long project wall. Painting with spray cans, Bernhardt reinvigorates graffiti actions such as bombing and tagging, collapsing distinctions between the art inside and outside the museum walls. Deanna Lawson explores and challenges conventional and stereotypical representations of the black body. She engages a range of photographic strategies to craft a multifaceted vision reflecting what she has described as a knowledge of selfhood through a corporeal dimension. Nicola Tyson is recognized for her feminist reimagining of the female body. She has referred to this as psychofiguration, an expression of the inner psyche by describing the body as experienced rather than merely observed. Her figures often appear turned inside out by the drama of their own self-exposure, the intensity heightened by Tyson's distinctive chromatic palette. Lisa Melandri, executive director of CAM, reminded me that the museum is committed to exhibiting the work of women artists, artists such as Maya Lin, Cindy Sherman, Louise Bourgeois, and Polly Applebaum have all had their work gracing the walls of CAM, to name just a few. I also went to the Palm Springs Art Museum in Palm Desert, California, which has a one-woman show of Pat Lash's exhibition titled Journeys of the Heart. Elizabeth Armstrong, the Joanne McGrath Executive Director, says, "As a pioneer who emerged from the downtown New York art scene of the 1970s, Lash embeds her work with rich narratives from her personal journey. Her practice is rooted in spirituality and always weighted with the pains and joys of heartbreak, age, and adventure. Driven by memory and experience, the artist incorporates a range of media from ceramic, bronze, and cut paper to wood sculpture and lace making into her art. Featuring the delicate cake and pastry sculptures for which she is best known, alongside early stitched canvas panels and stunning pipe paint dresses, this exquisite work is intensely biographical. At the same time, Lash's artwork stems from a resolutely feminist perspective that connects it to qualities and issues that next-generation contemporary artists are working through today. But I must throw in a quote for one of Longmire Sculpture Park's past directors, Mary Lou Canode. She said, "The visibility of women in the visual arts has changed over the past few years. St. Louis is a perfect example of how women have matriculated into leadership positions. Almost all of the visual arts museums in town are led by women, but the statistics regarding the number of women artists showing across the country in galleries and museums is disconcerting. While women are almost half the graduates of art schools, newspapers and art magazines record the slide of representing women artists in the market. We need another round of consciousness raising about the importance women artists, curators, and philanthropists have had and continue to have in shaping the visual arts. So, ladies, don't rest on your laurels, although there have recently been great laurels to rest on. Keep on trucking along and stay in the headlines. I'm Nancy Kranzberg."
Nancy Kranzberg has been involved in the arts community for more than 30 years on numerous arts-related boards. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the trend and the future of virtual reality in St. Louis with several people who head local virtual reality companies here. We'll also revisit our discussion about the Missouri History Museum's Route 66 exhibition as it enters its final week. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Alicia Lee, Monica Ramirez, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.